right next to our sticker would be a Suzuki sticker. But I never heard of Suzuki incurring any fines. One of our first sponsored riders was an up-and-coming teenager named Brian Deegan. He would later go on to form the Metal Militia, a notorious motocross team that took the Moto Triple X philosophy to the next level. In 1997, we entered him in the AMA Supercross Championships at the LA Coliseum. It was only our team's second major race, but in front of 46,000 stunned spectators, Brian took first fucking place. As he flew over the final jump to cross the finish line, he let go of his bike and let it sail through the air, and he made motocross history. The crowd went apeshit. It was as if the Bad News Bears had just beaten the New York Yankees. No one could believe an independent team of obnoxious punks had beaten the multi-billion-dollar Japanese corporate machine. One of the astonished announcers on ESPN wondered aloud, "Can you win a race and not be on the bike at the finish line?" His fellow announcer answered, "Well, he just did." The AMA awarded Brian a $2,500 purse for his victory and then fined him $1,000 for his hazardous ghost ride. It didn't matter. Brian's career took off, and Moto Triple X couldn't be ignored after that. The videos kept selling, the victories piled up, and Moto Triple X became infamous in the motocross scene and an ever-growing thorn in the AMA side. Over the next decade, we grew so much we could afford to pay some of our riders $150,000 a year. Jordan, Kurt, and I never made any profit because every dollar we made went back into expenses and employees and traveling and promotion. It cost about $500,000 a year just to keep the team running, and we were never able to hook a big enough sponsor to relieve the burden. And as videos became more widely available on the internet, our VHS and DVD sales ground to a halt. When the economy finally took a huge shit in 2008, it spelled the end. The few sponsors we had pulled out, and we couldn't afford to put the team on the road. We had to walk away. But for 14 years, we hung in with the corporate teams and we kicked their asses. And we remain the most successful privateer team in history in terms of results and longevity. We traveled and raced and had the time of our lives. And it became a much healthier outlet for me than drugs, drinking, and knocking out random skinheads. I still ride and race to this day. Recently, I was in a Starbucks and I noticed a woman with a Moto Triple X sticker on her laptop. I couldn't help but smile with pride. It's a phenomenon that has spread further than my herpes.
Chapter 91, Hefe. My daughter Kaylin was born in the middle of my nightclub madness, and between NoFX's touring schedule and the stress of the club, I could hardly enjoy my first couple years of fatherhood. The one place I could let loose was on this new thing called the Warped Tour. There was something about the Warped Tour's summer camp vibe. It brought out the troublemaker in everyone. I had the same let's see if I can get away with this attitude that I did when I was doing movie extra work with Gumdrop Lou, or when I was bouncing off the walls as a young kid. Those first few Warped Tours all blend together. We had a half-hour set during the day, a barbecue at night, and 23 hours of time to kill in between. So depending on the tour, I paired up with Fletcher from Pennywise, or Lars from Rancid, or Trey from Green Day, or Brody from the Distillers, and searched for trouble. Brody and I shot bottle rockets into one of the production buildings, where everyone had their computers and tour paperwork set up. Some lady came running out of the office and caught Brody, but I got away. To Brody's credit, she didn't rat me out as the mastermind. Trey had a paintball gun, and we sniped other bands' buses. My impersonation skills came in handy when I got a hold of a walkie-talkie and pretended to be Dickie from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
"This is Dickie from the Bosstones. Can you send some Vaseline tissues over to my bus? And don't tell my wife, okay?"
The girls in the production office thought it was hilarious. Dickie, not so much. I guess he heard the broadcast over someone else's walkie because his voice came crackling back.
"Who the fuck is that? That's not me!"
Before Kevin Lyman, the Warped Tour founder slash organizer, was able to confiscate my walkie, I played plenty of other games to entertain the production girls.
"Can we get some security assistance over at the NoFX bus? We have a serious problem."
"Who is this?"
This is Bob Backslide. I'm new in production."
"I'm at the NoFX bus. I don't see anything going on. What are you talking about?"
Oh, now it's over by the Pennywise bus.
I ran the security guy from bus to bus until he came to the production office and busted me.
Damn it, Jefe!
Oh, hey, you got my fax. The production girls later made me a special laminate with the name Bob Backslide on it. Usually it was just harmless fun, but I've always had a problem with knowing where to draw the line. One night, Fletcher and I commandeered a bunch of hot dog vending carts, pushed them into a pile topped by some cardboard boxes, doused them with lighter fluid, and set them ablaze. We had no end goal. It was just the most possible trouble we could get into at the moment. I have no idea how it was eventually extinguished, or if Kevin Lyman ever knew that I was responsible for the fire. I stepped up the destruction one night in Kansas with Lars, or was it Trey, when we tossed a bunch of smoke bombs into a porta-potty and peer pressured one of the stagehands into using his forklift to drop the porta-potty into the nearby river. We cheered as the potty dropped into the water and floated off into the distance, spewing plumes of smoke out of the open door. Kevin Lyman woke up to a $10,000 fine for the environmental damage he had caused, not to mention the replacement cost of the porta-potty. The stagehand was sent home. I would have copped to it if I knew he was going to get fired, but he was gone before I had a chance. Then again, maybe Kevin knew it was us, and his hands were tied, because he knew he couldn't kick the two biggest headliners off the tour. Either way, Kevin, sorry for all the trouble I caused on your tour, and you should drop by sometime. I've got some amazing pictures of a porta-potty gently making its way down the Kansas River.
Chapter 92, Melvin. I was taking a peaceful dump one morning on the Warp Tour when I noticed some movement through the gap in the door of the porta-potty. A moment later, the whole thing started shaking, and I felt it lift off the ground. I tried to open the door, but the porta-potty had been loaded onto a forklift from the front, so the door was pinned closed. I pushed and struggled and managed to get the door open about an inch. Hey! Hey! The noise from the forklift drowned out my shouts. I screamed louder and pounded on the door as I imagined myself getting dropped and covered in shit, piss, and toxic blue chemicals. Finally, I felt the forklift lower the porta-potty to the ground. I burst through the door and saw one of the production guys we'd been hanging out with. Dude, what the fuck? Melvin, I'm sorry. I thought nobody was in there. The guy was fired and sent home the next day, but not because I told anybody what happened. Apparently he got drunk that same night and dumped one of the porta-potties in the river. At least I hadn't been trapped inside that one.
Chapter 93, Mike. 115 degrees is hot no matter where you are, but it seems even hotter in Houston, Texas. The organizers of the 98 Warp Tour decided to move the show to an indoor venue, which was an old shed where they normally sold cattle or something. It was shaded, but it sounded like the bands were playing inside a huge tin can. I was tempted to cancel because we knew the fans would not get their money's worth, but Kevin Lyman begged us not to. The legend goes that we took the stage, played our set, and then, by way of apologizing for the shitty sound, threw our guarantee, $5,000 in cash, out to the audience in singles. The truth is that our guarantee was actually $12,000, we just told the crowd it was $5,000, and the other truth is that we only threw out $2,500 in bills. Warped Tour was a blast for us nearly every year we played, but 98 is still the year I'll remember the most. Bad Religion and Rancid were on the bill, and we were all friends, so we hung out every day, and we had our own private battle of the bands to see who got the best crowd reactions. At the time, we were, in my opinion, three of the best active punk bands. So we set the bar high for each other, and we all turned in some of our best performances. Brian Baker for Bad Religion watched us play every single day. He had his own reserved seat on a speaker on the side of the stage. I'll never forget him telling me, "I can watch you guys every day. It's always a different show." It was an honor. I mean, Chris from Anti-Flag watched us every day, too, but, you know, who cares?
Chapter 94, Melvin. On the 98 Warp Tour, I met a girl who I'll call Abby Froman, from a ska band I'll call the Sausage Kings. She had bright red hair, and I had bright blue hair, so when we started dating, everyone thought we were the cutest couple they ever did see. I don't remember how we met. The whole summer was a blur of booze, drugs, and barbecues, but I remember the attraction was instant, and by the second week of the tour, we were an item. It was a perfect summer of playing and partying, and with the endorphins of new love, and possibly some residual ecstasy, running through my system, my heart ran away with my head. We were driving a rental car along a country road in North Carolina on a day off, on our way to meet up with Abby's family. On an impulse, I pulled over and said, "Will you marry me?" I don't know why I said it. I have a romantic side that doesn't process reality sometimes. I just thought, it would be so great if we got engaged right now. And for whatever reason, no other part of my brain tried to stop me or point out that we'd been dating only a couple weeks and maybe I should take a minute to think about this decision. I always wanted to find a nice girl to spend my life with. Why not Abby? And I also wanted to be this amazing person who brought happiness to her life, and it seemed like this would do it. It worked. She said yes. We hugged and kissed and got back on the road to our aunt's house, and a little while later, my brain woke up and asked, "What the fuck did you just do?" We went to the New York Diamond District, with its mazes of steel doors and bulletproof glass, and I bought her a ring with 5 kite-shaped diamonds, mounted together to form a star, from a very serious-looking Orthodox Jew. Despite making small steps toward being a more open, communicative person, it was easier for me to have fun and play along rather than explain that I had just rushed into this. My mind was so afraid of allowing itself to doubt my decision that it would have been easier for me to steal from one of those diamond merchants than to simply sit down with Abby and talk about how I felt. Abby moved into my house in L.A. and, predictably, things soon went south. We had barely known each other for a month and a half, and most of that time was spent on the road. If we'd had time to get to know each other without any pressure, maybe things would have developed, but with the cloud of the engagement over me, I was hypersensitive to the smallest irritation. If she said anything negative, my brain spun it into, "Why is she so negative all the time? I can't be around someone so negative. She is negatively impacting my life." And over time, it allowed me to build up the false justification I needed to break up with her. No matter what she did or said, I internally framed it as a reason why I should just get out of the relationship. She opened up to me about issues from her childhood, and instead of being supportive, I told myself it was a red flag that might mean trouble down the road. I was acting like a coward. Actually, a coward would have just started a fight and found an excuse to break up. What I did was worse. When I finally tried to end it, she said she didn't want to break up, so I suggested she just move out for a while and we could rebuild things slowly and naturally. It wasn't a bad idea. It might have even worked if I'd had any intention of following through with it. But instead, I just stopped calling her. I couldn't be more ashamed about how I treated her. I heard she wore the ring for a long time after it was over. Aside from a couple of emails, I haven't seen or spoken to her since we broke up. But my dad friended her on Facebook a while back. He even went to her house for a Passover Seder. I'm hoping that counts as a small sign of forgiveness. Lexi knew everyone in the Albuquerque punk scene, but then again, it was a pretty small scene. We met in the early days of NOFX, and I saw her every time we traveled through New Mexico, but we were always just friends. Sometime after I broke up with Abby, Lexi visited L.A., and I met up with her at a friend's party. Despite Puck from MTV's The Real World trying to cock-block me, Lexi and I went home together, and a 2-year relationship began. A previous girlfriend had gotten me into E when we were partaking in the early 90s rave scene, and I discovered Klonopin soon after. But Lexi and I became mostly partial to cocaine. She worked as a cocktail waitress at a Hollywood strip club, and she would bring home coke for us. The place closed at 2 a.m., so she usually didn't make it home until 3. Sometimes I'd meet her at the club and we'd do lines before she left work. Then we started buying bindles here and there. As our use became more habitual, it made sense to buy in bulk. My dealer wasn't the kind of guy you could call at midnight to meet you somewhere and sell you an 8-ball. He had a $400 minimum order and he didn't work after dark. He didn't look like a drug dealer. He was an average white guy in a polo shirt with a boring haircut. But his stuff was the best in town. He believed in his product, too. I remember him showing off how flaky one of his batches was. I nodded, pretending to be impressed, but I didn't need a sales pitch. I didn't throw many huge parties. The coke was mostly for me, Lexi, and the occasional friend who would stop by. I met the guys from Weezer in Japan and partied with them on the Warped Tour. Their bassist at the time, Mikey Welsh, called me to hang out when we were in L.A., and we did blow all night and then did it again a night or two later. Then a month or two later, Weezer put out a press release saying their bassist had left the band and checked into a psychiatric hospital. He'd had a mental breakdown, partially due to drug use. I felt a little guilty for contributing to his downfall, but I wondered if I maybe also gave him the push he needed to get clean. Either way, they found him dead in a Chicago hotel room in 2011. Suspected drug overdose leading to a heart attack. Rest in peace, Mikey. And once Mike started doing coke, he and I teamed up to buy a few baseball-sized bricks of it to take on the Warped Tour. It became our thing. Everyone on the tour knew which bus had the blow. And soon it got to a point where, if we were on someone else's bus, they'd automatically put out a line for us without us asking for it. In retrospect, it seems excessive, but at the time we felt like we had some cool little secret, like we were in the Bad Boys Club. For a guy who had a problem with communication, cocaine seemed like the perfect medicine. For years, I would smoke weed and fade into the background of every party, or I would sit with a beer while conversations were carried by others. Cocaine turned me from a listener into a talker. And when people learn you have several hundred dollars worth of powder in your possession, you make a lot of new friends. I never saw a downside to the drug until one night in New York City when Mike, Aaron, and some friends of ours rented a limo for a night of partying, and I broke into a sweat after inhaling a fat line in the back seat. I was shaking, and someone asked me if I was okay. My heart was slamming against my rib cage, and sweat cascaded down my forehead into my eyes. It was a frightening moment, but not frightening enough to stop me from doing more blow later that night. It was one thing to do coke on tour or at a party, but most of the time I just did it at my house. I would stay up until 5 a.m. on a Tuesday, passing a mirror back and forth with a friend, thinking we were talking about everything while we were really talking about nothing. We were doing the coke because the coke was there, not because we were particularly enjoying it. As the next year went by, I didn't like the way it made me feel anymore. I would wake up with a hangover, even if I hadn't done any for a few days. And waking up just in time to watch the sun go down stopped being the mark of a good party and started becoming depressing. I still had everything that had made me so happy a few years prior, but now I felt empty and unfulfilled. I used to enjoy being active and going to the gym. Now, I couldn't motivate myself to get off the couch unless it was to head to a bar. I grew bitter, and instead of blaming the drugs, I blamed Lexi. It was an ugly, complicated breakup because she had moved into my house and our lives were intertwined on every level, all the way down to our cell phone plans. And after breaking up with her, I was still passing the mirror every night and still depressed and hungover all the time. I had a series of flings and one-night stands, which may sound glamorous to some guys, but it was less about sex and more about some sad search for validation. It wasn't until the birth of my first son, years later, that drugs faded from my life. In the meantime, I had found a substance that finally made me chatty, but it still couldn't get me to truly communicate, least of all with myself.
Chapter 95, Mike. The biggest mistake most singers make when they start a side project is that they still sing. No one wants to hear that. They may as well just listen to the original band. So when Joey from Lagwagon and I started discussing the idea of a punk cover band, we knew neither one of us should be on vocals. Spike Slosson worked in the warehouse at Fat Records and sang AC/DC covers in a bar band on the side. He was our second choice. Starting a band with a group of friends from San Francisco bands was a concept. We could play random gigs in SF for fun or as an excuse to party. Marty from Bracket was the first choice, but then I realized he didn't drink. Spike was in. Me First and the Gimme Gimmes were born in 1995 and has so far refused to stop. despite being told that Glenn Frey hated our version of Desperado and being booed by 32,000 people during our version of Stairway to Heaven at a Pittsburgh Pirates game. The Gimmies can also be credited, or blamed, for introducing me to cocaine at age 31. At an after-show party in Berlin on the Gimmies' first European tour in 1999, everyone was sitting around a big table doing coke and peer-pressuring me about it like they were stars of an after-school special. The dealer who brought the drugs sprinkled some coke in my beer, so I drank that, and it gave the beer some extra zing. I spent the rest of the evening doing lines in the bathroom at the Franken with our guitarist, Chris Shiflett. I was hooked. I mean, not hooked like addicted. Hooked like the first time I tried bondage. The truth about cocaine is that it's not that great. It's just that doing cocaine is better than not doing it. Like with pills, coke was a tool for me to counterbalance my drunkenness. But of course, the downside is that it turns you into the most interesting person in the world. To yourself. Ecstasy, on the other hand, is a fucking blast. Your whole body feels tingly. It makes everything better. It releases serotonin and dopamine. I wish I had some right now. But I'm trying to take it less often because it takes a few days for your serotonin levels to normalize, and supposedly it makes holes in your brain. Still, kind of worth it. Ray Harvey, our booking agent in Australia, handed me my first hit of ecstasy in the spring of 2000, after a festival show we played with Pennywise. The festival was on some remote farm in a town called Torquay, so the only place to party after our set was the post-show rave. About an hour after I dosed, Fletcher looked at me and said, "Your pupils just got huge, dude." An electronic group called Sonic Animation was on stage, and they featured two colorful, fuzzy, costumed characters that looked like the unholy love children of Cookie Monster and the Pillsbury Doughboy. The ecstasy turned those fuzzy idiots into the funniest things we'd ever seen. We were all shouting at them, "Blue character, I love you! Fuck you, yellow character, you're no blue character, blue character!" We went all night and into the next morning, when we had an hour and a half van ride to the airport. Kent had done so much ecstasy that he ceased making sense. He wouldn't shut up, but he also wouldn't form complete sentences, or even complete words. "Oh, this one time I was gives and where and sometime I and never I see." We shouted at him to shut up, but he went on for the whole van ride. In the summer of 2000, we headlined an 8-band bill in front of 12,000 people at an outdoor show in London. It was our biggest headlining show at that point. We'd played festivals before, but this was our show and our crowd. It was a landmark moment for us, and we had everything to prove. So, of course, I convinced Hefe and Melvin to do ecstasy with me before we played. None of us had ever played on ecstasy before. It was a way to challenge ourselves and to say fuck you to the way things are supposed to be. We talked a lot on stage, but that wasn't unusual for us. And it got sloppy toward the end, especially when Melvin had to play his accordion. But again, not unusual. Overall, we pulled it off, and cocaine and ecstasy became part of my touring arsenal. Over the years, I had to give up Vicodin before shows because it would dry up my vocal cords and fuck up my voice. My voice kind of sounds fucked up now. And I learned that doing coke before a show just left me wanting more in the middle of the set. But I found a new formula that worked for me. Valium with 4 vodka drinks before a show to loosen up, 2 or 3 vodka drinks during the show to have some fun, and a line of coke during the encore to even out the drunkenness. And then lots of coke after the show to fuel the party for a few more hours. The concoction served me well and provided consequence-free good times for a while.
Chapter 96, Smelly. There are 3 shows in the history of NoFX that will always stand out in my mind. The first is when we played Reno on our first tour and 300 people slammed to our music for the first time. The second was the Bizarre Festival, when Courtney slapped me in the head and we played to our first festival crowd. And the third is when we headlined in London to more than 10,000 people on Three Mills Island. I remember the lights and the sea of heads, the tsunami of crowd noise. I didn't even get pissed when Mike admitted to me on stage that he, Hefe, and Melvin were on ecstasy. As cynical and sarcastic as we are, and as nonchalant about our success as we can be, we were proud of ourselves that night. We're not the kind of band that high fives or group hugs after our shows, but we all hugged that night when we walked off stage. A year and a half later, we returned to the UK to play a festival called Gig on the Green in Glasgow, Scotland. Early in the day, Rugley, our guitar tech, came into the production office and told me and Kent a story about how one of the local crew guys was drunkenly bugging him and Jay for a free t-shirt. When Rugley told the guy off, He spat on Ruli and took a swing, so Jay clocked the guy in the face. They weren't sure if it was Jay's punch or Rugley's follow-up, or the fact that the guy's head smacked into a parked car as he dropped, but he ended up unconscious with a broken jaw. Later, Jay was unloading some merch from the back of the box truck with Frida, our European merch salesman, when the broken jaw guy entered the truck with two of his friends, a tall, tough guy who looked like a human tree trunk and a squat, bulky dude who looked like haggis with eyes. Tree trunk guy grabbed Jay and bounced him off the walls of the truck like a ragdoll. Broken jaw came at Jay with a broken bottle, but Frida intercepted him and tangled him up. Jay broke free from tree trunk, and Frida yelled, "Run for it!" Jay ran down the ramp out of the truck. Haggis tried to follow him, but he tripped on the ramp and ate shit. Jay escaped backstage and told me the story. I don't know how Frida managed to get out of there. It turned out that Broken Jaw and his buddies were part of some local biker gang, and soon there were rumors circulating backstage that our band was due for payback. We had to walk a few hundred yards down a dirt road to get from the dressing room to the stage, so we asked some of the cops working security to escort us when it was time for our set. They refused. They knew who was after us, and they didn't want any part of what might be coming our way. We started our long walk. Jay and Limo were carrying crates with bottles of water and booze for the stage. As we got to the ramp that led to the stage, Broken Jaw and Tree Trunk came out of nowhere, along with 10 of their friends. Jay dropped his crate and got into a fight stance. Limo hockey-checked Tree Trunk to the ground. Broken Jaw grabbed a bottle from Jay's crate and hurled it at Jay. It nearly missed Jay's head and smashed on the side of the truck next to us. A dozen Scottish hooligans were yelling and grabbing at us. I pulled one of them off Jay as Jay went tumbling to the dirt. Jay scrambled under a semi, disappeared into the crowd, and made his way back to the bus to hide. The rest of us made it to the stage, and security kept the gang dudes away from us. We played our set while these thugs waited for us in the wings. One of them was brandishing a screwdriver and yelling, "I'm gonna fucking stab you in the fucking heart." They kept giving us the universal sign for, "I'm gonna cut your throat." In the middle of the show, the power was cut. The threats and sign language continued. The power came back on. The power went back out. Repeat. We somehow made it through the tensest set of our lives. There was a police paddy wagon waiting for us by the stage to escort us back to our bus. Mike, Aaron, Hefe, and Melvin jumped in and bailed, but I refused to leave the crew behind. I remember thinking, "Those fucking pussies," as I handed out pieces of my drum hardware to the crew so we could defend ourselves. The paddy wagon never returned. The crew and I took turns watching each other's backs and loaded the gear into a truck that was backed up to the stage. By the time we were done, most of the biker dudes had dispersed. We walked back down that long dirt road, and the remaining bikers threw garbage, bottles, and insults at us for a while, but we made it back to our tour bus, unbloodied. The bikers went from bus to bus looking for us, and our driver met them outside and convinced them we were on some other bus. When they were gone, he came on board and said, "All right, I fixed it for you, but we have to get out of here." None of us relaxed until well after we crossed the border into England. We'll go back to almost any part of the UK on any given day, but 2002 was the last show NoFX will ever play in Scotland.
Chapter 97, Mike. My friend Jim Cherry called me from a payphone one night and told me he had a gun to his head. What he said was, "The last thing I want to say is thank you and so much for everything you've given me. If it wasn't for you, I'd still be laying carpet." Jim was the original bassist for Strung Out, one of the first bands signed to Fat Records. But he was voted out of the band in 1999 and never fully recovered from the heartbreak. To mask his depression, he developed a 50 Vicodin-a-day drug habit. The pills had run out, and that's what brought on the phone call. I told him not to do it. He was in L.A., and I was in San Francisco. I said, "If you really do appreciate what I've done for you, let me come down and try to help you." "You'll come down here? You'll do that for me?" "Of course I will, Jim." I was on a plane at 6 o'clock that morning. I picked him up, we ate, and I drove him to the same rehab facility where Smelly had gotten clean. Smelly pulled some strings to get him admitted, and I footed the bill. After 3 months, Jim emerged clean and sober. He dove back into songwriting for his new band, Zero Down. He was happy and thankful of all the good things he had in his life. Less than 6 months later, Jim died in his sleep from a heart defect unrelated to his drug use. When your time is up, it's up. I cared about Jim, but I didn't cry when I heard the news. Just like I didn't cry when I heard about the numerous suicides, overdoses, fatal car wrecks, or other premature deaths of a number of friends before and after Jim. It's not that I wasn't saddened by their deaths, and it's not that I've never broken down into tears over the loss of someone close to me, but I do wonder if I have a problem with empathy. I care, I love, and I feel, but maybe I've got a disconnect inside me that sometimes keeps my really heavy emotions at bay. My only theory about where that disconnect comes from is my BMX bike. When I was 10, someone stole my Huffy bike behind my mom's apartment, even though I had chained it to the railing. My dad was pissed, but he replaced it with a brand new Diamondback. A month later, someone snapped the lock off my bike at school and stole the Diamondback too. My dad lost his shit. He yelled at me and berated me and blamed me for the bike being stolen, even though I had properly locked it up. I cried, of course. I was just a kid, and I couldn't make sense of why it was my fault. Even apologizing to my dad didn't seem to make things right. And why should I apologize? When I calmed down a few hours later, I made a conscious decision. I was going to stop caring about things. Caring about things only causes me stress and tears. My dad cared about things, and it turned him into a dick. Maybe if I could teach myself to not care about material possessions, I could avoid ever feeling like this again. I think I became an accidental Buddhist. That philosophy has stuck with me and has shaped the ethos of NoFX. I don't play fancy guitars. I drive an Econoline van. Stuff isn't important to me. I don't spend money on things to own. I spend money on things that make me happy. Good food, good times with friends, travel, latex clothing. I'm not saying I haven't treated myself to a few nice things. I just don't let myself get bummed out when those things break or go missing. I think it's the healthiest way to live. Except for one drawback. In my quest to stop caring about things, I seem to have allowed myself to care less about people. I built an emotional wall inside myself at age 10, and I didn't have any way of knowing where that wall should begin or end. It's protected me from a lot of pain, but in my attempt to care less, I worry that I've taught myself not to care enough. One time my roommate, Brian, told me he just tried to hang himself. I was making potatoes and beans in the kitchen when he walked in with a gash above his eye. "I tried to hang myself just now." "What are you talking about?" he said. "I tried to hang myself with this whip, but it broke." He held up the old bullwhip and explained how he had ended up falling and banging his head against the dresser. Like my ex-girlfriend Wendy, Brian was a bike messenger. And like Wendy, he got a bad head injury on the job that had fucked his brain up. He said strange things all the time that had no relation to the conversation. "You shouldn't do that," was all I could think to say. At the time, I didn't know how to handle a situation like that. Do I call the cops? Do I have him committed? I talked it over with Aaron, and we couldn't come up with any decent answers. Thankfully, the next day he seemed normal again. So we naively hoped that it was just one of his characteristic post-brain injury non sequiturs. The next night, everyone in the house was getting ready to go out to a party when we heard Brian's ex-girlfriend scream. She had broken up with him and moved out of the house very recently, because he had become unbearably depressed and unhappy since the bike accident. But she was going to join us at the party tonight. Brian was in his room listening to the first Damned album and drinking Jägermeister, and she went to check on him. When we heard her scream, we all went rushing into his room to discover Brian, hanging from a transom with a noose made out of a TV cable. I lifted Brian up, and our roommate Jerry untied the cable to get him down. Brian let out a "ugh," so we thought he might still be alive, but it was just air escaping his lungs. I checked his pulse and checked for breathing. He was already gone. His face looked like it had been dipped in red paint because all the blood that rushed to his head gushed out of the cut he'd made over his eye that previous night. Snot and pus oozed from his mouth and nose, and the smell of his evacuated bowels filled the room. We called 911, and some paramedics arrived in about 10 minutes. Relatively speaking, it was a fast response. But take a moment right now to imagine someone you know lying on the floor in a slowly growing pool of blood, pus, and shit, with everyone shrieking and crying uncontrollably. Now hold that image for 10 straight minutes. After the coroner took his body away, we all still went to the party. We weren't being callous, we just couldn't bear to just sit around the house. When we came back, Jerry's girlfriend and her speed freak friends went straight to Brian's room, rifled through his things, and took his leather jacket and his records. Aaron, Jerry, and I couldn't believe they were doing it. But before his parents came up and took all his stuff, I did take one RKL record. Brian's girlfriend later went on to marry the singer of RKL. I don't know if that counts as coincidence, but it's a little weird, right? We tried to clean the blood out of the carpet before his parents arrived a couple days later, but we didn't do a great job. They just stood there looking at the stain, crying. I didn't tell them about my conversation with Brian in the kitchen, partially because it wouldn't have helped their grief in any way, partially because of my own sense of guilt. While most people would have been emotionally scarred by the experience of cutting their roommate's body down from a noose, the disconnect I developed at age 10 allowed me to move on without letting it sink in too deep. But maybe that's not a good thing. Two of my housemates had to go into therapy after Brian's death. That's the price you pay for caring, I guess. But maybe caring is worth the price. I don't think about Brian much. I was much closer to Jim, but I can't say that I get misty-eyed when I think of him either. It wouldn't be until the birth of my daughter that the walls inside me started to crack. And it wouldn't be until the death of another dear friend that they would completely crumble.
Chapter 98, Hefe. I was young and naive when I first got married, so it's no surprise that it ended in divorce within a couple years. After the split, I cut loose for a year or two, but I interrupted my rebound with another doomed engagement to a woman named Nicole. We moved in together way too fast, and we got engaged way too fast. Maybe if I had taken my time, I would have looked deeper into her eyes. You don't need a urine sample to determine what type of drug someone is using. You just need to look into their eyes. Bloodshot? Probably weed. Huge dilated pupils? Coke or LSD. When someone is on heroin or opiates, all their muscles relax, including the ones in their eyes. So the pupils shrink down to these tiny little pinholes. I had seen those eyes on Smelly and Carlton and so many of the dogpatch winos at the Fountain House. Now I was seeing them on my fiancé. Nicole was sick all the time, but I chalked it up to legitimate illness. She disappeared randomly and didn't show up when she was supposed to, but I chalked it up to flakiness. But when I noticed her eyes, it all fell into place. The sickness was sometimes a result of heroin withdrawal, and sometimes just an excuse to go to the hospital to score morphine. The disappearances were due to meetings with dealers and fellow users who were grinding up and snorting OxyContin. And of course, she was always short on cash. Every day there was another story like, I crashed into some guy's car in this parking lot. I'd offer to make out a check, and she'd come up with this flimsy reason for me to write it in her name instead of writing it out to the owner of the phantom dented car. I caught Nicole in lie after lie and confronted her about her pinned pupils, but she never admitted to doing anything until one day, with her mother by her side for support, she confessed it all. Her mom kept a cool head and said, I understand if you don't want to be with my daughter anymore. It's up to you. Just give us the word, and we will take her out of here, and she'll be out of your life. I tried to do the honorable thing. We were engaged, after all. I said I'd stick with her and try to help her through her recovery. I upheld my end. She didn't uphold hers. She lied about going to counseling appointments. I'd find out she hadn't been there in weeks. She came home high and made up more excuses about why she needed money. I finally signed her into an inpatient rehab clinic because she couldn't stay clean. When I dropped her off, it was over. I didn't tell her that at the time. She had enough to deal with. But I knew I wouldn't be picking her up when she got out. I first noticed Jen when the robots behind MySpace.com suggested that she and I should connect online due to our mutual cyber friends. When I clicked on her profile, not only did I discover a sexy blonde that I wouldn't mind meeting, but I noticed that her profile photo had some sort of animation and would flip from picture to picture, and I wanted to know how it was done. I kept sending her messages, but she wouldn't give me the time of day. But I was persistent, and after a month or so, I got her phone number. We met up the next time NoFX had a gig in L.A. She lived in nearby Valencia and hung out at a bar after the show. I ended up changing my flight home and spending 5 extra days with her. Then she flew up to Humboldt County, and we spent another week together. And we bounced back and forth like that for a while. We traded immature jokes, drank beer, and watched the sun come up from my hot tub. We couldn't get enough of each other, but she was reluctant to let me call her my girlfriend. It was hard to blame her, a guy in a band with an ex-wife and a kid who lived 600 miles away. Not exactly the image of a guy looking to commit. I showed her I was committed by offering her a promise ring, and she finally agreed to give us a try. Over the next few months, we got to know each other more intimately. I watched her connect with my daughter, and I saw what a life together might look like. Before NoFX left for that summer's Warped Tour, I took her to Clam Beach, dropped to one knee, and presented an engagement ring. She said yes. At the end of the summer, Jen flew out to our Warped Tour date in North Carolina to surprise me for my birthday. She decorated our bus with streamers and balloons and brought out 20 pounds of my favorite tri-tip on ice, which Kent grilled up to perfection that night. No woman had ever done anything like that for me before. My past relationships always imploded the minute things got serious, but with Jen, things kept getting better. About 6 weeks later, when Jen was on tour with me in Rio de Janeiro, she started feeling nauseous. We thought it might be from the long flight or a bad piece of meat from dinner. But when the nausea persisted, she took a pregnancy test in our hotel room. The instructions were in Portuguese, but the results were clear. We stood on our hotel balcony, looked out at the ocean, and held each other while both silently thinking, "Oh, shit." Jen and I were both petrified at the thought of explaining the situation to her religious parents, especially her dad, a retired police officer trained in the use of firearms. I thought about disappearing into the streets of Rio, changing my name to Roberto, and making my way by selling bananas to tourists, but her folks were overjoyed to find out that they were going to be grandparents, and I turned away from the banana-selling life. We had to change our wedding plans and elope in Vegas before she gave birth, but after our son Jaden was born, we had a proper ceremony in Malibu with Jay Walker serving as our officiant. The guys in the band still love to make fun of me for meeting my wife on MySpace, but the truth is our relationship is the most stable and fulfilling I've ever experienced. And when Jaden's teacher tells us that our son has been making fart noises in his class, I'm glad I have someone in my life who can explain why I shouldn't be giggling.
Chapter 99, Mike. I didn't like George Bush from the very beginning. I didn't like that he, as governor of Texas, oversaw the execution of 152 inmates, several who have been since proven innocent or had serious doubts raised about their guilt. I didn't like the way his dad ran the country. I didn't like his party. I didn't like how he stole the 2000 election. I suspected he would fuck up the country pretty bad if he was in office, and by 2002, my suspicions had been soundly confirmed. The USA Patriot Act, stem cell research restrictions, anti-abortion measures, pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol, tax cuts for the rich that plunged us into a record deficit. He was every liberal's worst nightmare, and he hadn't even invaded Iraq yet. We played a bunch of shows in Florida in 2002, and I thought back to the 2000 election and how everything had supposedly hinged on just a few hundred votes. We had played Florida in 2000 as well, to at least 2,000 people each night. I couldn't help but think that if I had used my public platform to encourage people to vote for Gore, maybe I could have swung the election the other way, or at least made it harder for Bush to steal it. Let me be clear. Both political parties in the U.S. suck, and our democracy is a joke. But while Bush was busy executing people, Gore was focusing on climate change. I'm not sure I would have approved of every single thing Gore would have done as president, but I'm sure our world would be a better place if he had been elected. There is a fucking difference. So I started a website, punkvoter.com, with the stated goal of removing George Bush from office in the 2004 election. Everyone at Fat Records pulled double duty to get the site up and running. We provided info about voter registration and reported on every terrible decision made by the Bush administration. We weren't Rock the Vote with a polite, nonpartisan agenda of increasing voter turnout. Our agenda was clear. Fuck George Bush. Our political director, Scott Goodstein, who would later go on to serve in a prominent role for the Obama campaign, got me invited to an event in New York where celebrities, activists, and representatives from various groups, like mine, gathered to discuss how John Kerry could defeat Bush. Scott introduced me around and explained Punk Voter to people. I was wearing a powder blue suit and had dyed and spiked hair, so I stood out among the crowd, by design. I pressed the flesh with people like Russell Simmons and Michael Moore, and I talked to Harold Ickes, Clinton's deputy chief of staff, for almost an hour. Scott also set up meetings with wealthy record company people in an attempt to get some donations for Punk Voter. But stepping back into that world made the bile rise in my throat. I didn't want to go out and beg for money. I already had money. We had bands, we had stages, we had a record label, we had media access. We were going to do things differently. Instead of financial donations, I called in every favor I could from every big band I knew and was able to put together a 2-volume compilation album titled Rock Against Bush. We did get a handful of very generous donations. Billy from Faith No More and Noodles from The Offspring kicked in 10 grand apiece, but it was way easier to get bands to donate a song than cash. We got songs from Green Day, Rancid, Foo Fighters, Sum 41, Dropkick Murphys, Ministry, Social Distortion, and even No Doubt. Almost every single band we approached said yes. Well, Blink-182 and The Vandals said no. And Good Charlotte agreed to give us a song, but they refused to do a Punk Voter photo shoot for a magazine because their manager was worried it might hurt their image. It was so inspiring to see people rallying around a cause and shedding the apathy that had plagued previous elections. It felt like we were really doing something positive and instigating tangible grassroots change. And then, of course, came the backlash. I've written political lyrics from the very beginning. Even our first 7-inch had political themes. But the serious songs tended to get overshadowed by our songs about refusing to shower or having sex with obese women. I was flooded with emails and internet comments telling me to stay out of politics. Every day it was, shut up, or what do you know, or you're drunk. But among all the negativity, there were tons of supportive emails too. I got an email from a kid who worked at KFC who had been inspired by our website to register all 12 of his co-workers to vote. I sat on a plane next to some Republican businessman for a short flight somewhere, and after 90 minutes, I had convinced him that George Bush was a bad person. We had a civil, polite conversation, but I spouted facts and figures that he wasn't aware of, and by the end of the flight, he said he wouldn't be voting for Bush again. Slowly but surely, we were reaching people. We raised over $1 million, which we used to take out magazine ads and put up billboards in the swing state of Ohio. It turned out to be enough to score myself an invite to a campaign brunch in San Francisco, where I got to meet John Kerry himself. I gave him a Rock Against Bush CD, and he seemed pretty stoked. He said he would listen to it on the plane en route to his next campaign stop. He was probably bullshitting, but I'd like to think he at least listened to Gas Chamber by the Foo Fighters. After 8 years of not doing a single interview, I finally had a reason to talk to the press again. I did something like 60 interviews and media appearances leading up to the election. I didn't care about advertising our band, but advertising Punk Voters seemed worthwhile. I always thought about that businessman I met on the plane. If I could convince one person on a short flight, I could convince a hell of a lot more people on a radio show. Throughout that spring, NoFX toured in support of Punk Voter, playing in front of more than 50,000 people. We brought Jello Biafra on the road with us to give political speeches before each performance, and we registered thousands of kids to vote every night. We also brought Scott Ritter on the road to speak to the crowds. He was a former Republican, a U.S. Marine, and one of the U.N. weapons inspectors who criticized the Bush administration for its rhetoric about WMDs. I remember playing craps with him and Jello Biafra one night in Vegas, and him telling us these crazy stories about how he had been fired for speaking out and how the government was trying to discredit him. Coincidentally, a sealed conviction for a misdemeanor sex crime was somehow made public in 2003. We also lost money at the tables that night. Not sure if I can blame Bush for that one, though. But mass media was able to reach 10 or 20 or 100 times as many people in one small interview segment than we were able to reach in months of touring. So along the way, we stopped at every radio station that would have us. And I did my best to promote the cause. It's not easy doing blow all night and then waking up at 6 a.m. to do a morning show. NoFX broke its print silence in the April 2004 issue of Alternative Press, which was a big enough deal to earn us the cover. The previous year, the Dixie Chicks had insulted George Bush on stage, and their fans went apeshit. The chicks fanned the fires of the controversy by appearing naked on the cover of Entertainment Weekly, so we parodied their photo shoot for RAP cover as a show of solidarity with them and as a middle finger to the punks who were turning against us. We stripped down and stared into the camera as serious as possible while strategically covering up our cocks and nipples. I think it resulted in Blockbuster refusing to stock the issue or something. AP was probably excited to have our first exclusive interview after so many years, but it should have been obvious that putting a naked, middle-aged punk band on the cover of their magazine really wasn't going to help their sales. I was nervous every time I had to represent Punk Voter in public because everyone is constantly trying to attack me. I knew if I misspoke or didn't have my facts straight, my comments would be dissected, and I would be called a liar and the message would get lost. I was weighed down by more responsibility for Punk Voter than I ever was for NoFX. Howard Stern was pretty fucking cool during my interview on his show, even though I wasn't at my most articulate due to the sun not being up yet. He had Michael Graves, the guy who sang for the Misfits in the late 90s, call in to represent the punk rock Republican point of view. And I was worried that I wasn't in any condition to effectively debate, but Howard tore him a new asshole without needing much of my help at all. Dennis Miller, however, was still proudly towing the Republican Party line. I was invited to be on his short-lived talk show along with Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! And Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation. I couldn't sleep for an entire week beforehand. I had done very little TV in the past, and I'd never publicly debated someone as smart and smug as Dennis Miller before. Miller's producer gave me a list of 15 points Dennis wanted to talk about. So I researched each topic exhaustively and hammered out some talking points in my head and tried to anticipate Dennis's counterpoints so I could offer some counterpoints. I was anxious, but I was ready. Dennis didn't ask me one fucking thing on the list. Amy Goodman went on first, and she's a fucking genius, so she destroyed Dennis. Eric Schlosser went out and destroyed him a second time. I went on third, and the first thing Dennis said was, "I find Bush to be more of a punk than Kerry." He made the case that Bush was more real than Kerry, and then asked, "Why would you want punk against Bush when he's your peeps?" I was befuddled. On any normal day, with a couple of drinks and some Valium in me, I would have had a sarcastic, witty retort locked and loaded. But this wasn't on the list. I froze and said something about John Kerry being a snowboarder and being in a band, which made him kind of punk rock. In my mind, I thought, so this is how it's going to be. He just got his ass kicked twice on the air, and he's going to take it out on me now. Dennis kept changing the subject, and I never really got to say the things I wanted to, and it was over before I knew it. I returned to the green room and met up with Vanessa, the PR person for Fat Records, who was by my side at most of these interviews and appearances. She reassured me that I had done well and said that one of Dennis's producers was next to her backstage and said he was actually backing me over Dennis when I was speaking. I watched the episode later and gave myself a B. I hung tough, but I could have done better. When NoFX was booked on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, we were only going to play music and I didn't have to sweat about a debate. But I wanted to be sure we could make a political statement with our performance. We would be playing the song Franco and American from our new album, The War on Errorism. The song isn't specifically about Bush, but in the course of performing it live on the Punk Voter Tour, I had changed the lyrics of the bridge to, "We all know George Bush is an imbecile. He loves Dick, but he hates homosexuals." It was an obvious play on the first name of Dick Cheney. But I thought some uptight network standards and practices people might not appreciate my clever turn of phrase. I made sure to specifically ask the censors about it and readily offered to change the words because I'd rather sing a different line than be bleeped. But they insisted the lyrics were acceptable. The mother bleepers bleeped me. And not only that, they bleeped the word "from" in the line, "I eat no breath mints because they're from de-hoofed horses." That one remains a mystery. We all wore anti-Bush t-shirts, and we had a flag with a picture of Bush's face painted like a clown draped over the keyboard. And the second line of our bridge, "We're sick and tired of the embarrassment. The whole world wants us to get a better president," was delivered intact, so we made as broad a statement as we possibly could with our 2.5 minutes of airtime. After we finished, Conan shook our hands and went to commercial, joking to the camera, "NoFX playing next week at the Republican National Convention." Networks never let late-night talk shows take a defined political stance because they'll alienate their viewers with different beliefs. So I think we caused a bit of turmoil behind the scenes. The show's booker, Debbie Wonder, was a friend of ours, and months later she told us there was a joke going around the show's offices about bands that wouldn't be invited back on the show. People would say, "Oh yeah, we'll have them back right after NoFX plays here again." On election night, I had a party at my house with a bunch of friends and all the people from FAT who had sacrificed so much to make punk voters successful. I invited Jello Biafra, but he didn't fucking show. After the party, I checked my phone and had 4 missed calls and a message from him asking, "Mike, what's your address?" "I'm on Glover. Where's your house?" So I'm pretty sure Jello spent election night 2004 just circling my block. I had 2 shot glasses full of pills ready for distribution, depending on which way the results went. Valium in case of a loss, ecstasy in case of a victory. When they called Ohio for Bush, a few people took the Valium, but most of us just took the ecstasy anyway. We hugged and congratulated each other for all our hard work. We were all teary-eyed, not so much because we were sad about losing, but because we were so proud of ourselves for putting so much effort into something we believed in. It was a very sad night, but it was also kind of nice. But the next day was definitely depressing. Not only had the reality of another term of Bush sunk in, but all of punk voters' enemies took to the internet and piled on the schadenfreude. People couldn't wait to tell me how I wasted my time and didn't change a fucking thing, and that I should have kept my big Jew nose out of politics. At subsequent Warped Tours, kids would say as much to me in person. And then to add injury to all the insults, I got hit with a $300,000 tax bill for the money we raised. We spent every penny of the million we had raised on putting out ads and sustaining the campaign, but because we are a partisan organization supporting a specific candidate, we weren't tax-exempt by the way Rock the Vote and other nonpartisan nonprofits are. Even the IRS was giving us shit. I have 0 regrets. As hectic and stressful as it was, that year and a half was probably my most important contribution to society and my most meaningful civil service. Sure, Bush stayed in office, but we turned shitloads of people onto politics who may have remained apathetic for the rest of their lives. And we registered tens of thousands of people to vote. The youth vote in 2004 was up about 4.3 million votes from 2000, and John Kerry won the youth vote by 10% over Bush, compared to Gore winning the youth vote by only 2%. And in 2006, when the Democrats finally took back the House and the Senate, the youth vote was even higher. Punk voter can't take credit for all of that, of course, but we were certainly a spoke in the wheel. We worked hard and combined our efforts with those who were like-minded, and together we pushed for the changes we wanted to see and ultimately made things a little better. That's kind of the whole point of democracy, right?
Chapter 100, Melvin. We played Conan on a day off during the same Warped Tour when Mike and I were flush with cocaine baseballs. I stayed sober for 2 days so I would be at my best for the taping, but I'd been using so heavily that it took 2 days for the come down to hit me. I had a nasty hangover and a pounding headache that peaked just before we performed. It was freezing in the studio in order to balance out the heat from the lights, so I was shaking because I was cold, I was shaking because I was coming down off weeks of partying, and I was shaking because I was nervous as hell about playing our first performance on network TV. I was on the edge of an anxiety attack when Conan announced us. I asked Mike for a Valium before we went on, but it didn't have time to kick in. I started playing Franco and American way too fast, but I didn't realize it, so when Smelly came in, I thought he was dragging the tempo, and it felt like we were blowing it. I tried to focus my uncontrollable nerves into jumping around in the small risers that functioned as a stage, but every time I landed, there was this huge bang, as if I weighed 1,000 pounds. You can hear it distinctly on the video. I didn't notice the cameras, or Conan, or the audience, or anything else until it was all over. I'd love to get another crack at playing on a show to make up for our sloppy performance, but from what I hear, we're not invited back.
Chapter 101, Mike. I was never all that driven to have a kid, but Duncan from Snuff told me it was a kind of love I could never otherwise understand. He said you can love your family, you can love your wife, you can love your friends, but nothing comes close to the love of your own children. That sounded like something I wouldn't want to miss, and when I finally experienced it, I discovered that Duncan was right. Of course, he neglected to mention that a deep, profound love was only part of the equation. There's also a deep, profound panic when a dog bites your child's skull, and a deep, profound disgust when you first have to scoop the shit out of your daughter's vagina during a diaper change. And he definitely didn't mention the deep, profound amount of vomiting on your clothes, on your bed, directly into your mouth, but I still have to say it's worth it. My daughter, Darla, was born in 2004 and was named after my favorite character from The Little Rascals. When we first brought her home, she would only sleep on my chest, which is an indescribable experience. As she's grown, I've had countless unforgettable moments of joy that I couldn't have otherwise achieved. All those drunken nights on tour took a backseat to the smile on Darla's face when, after 4 incredibly frustrating days of me trying to teach her, she finally learned how to ride a bike. Growing up with an absentee dad made me very conscious of the value of quality time. Even though I'm on tour for a good chunk of the year, I call and video chat from the road whenever possible, and when I'm home, it's Daddy Darla time. I never just plop her in front of the TV. We do shit together. We go on hikes, and she fearlessly picks up banana slugs and salamanders. I never thought I'd make a sober trip to Las Vegas, but one day, there I was, trying to fit 15 stuffed animals she won at Circus Circus into the overhead compartment on our flight home. People who work normal jobs probably spend a few hours with their kid each night before bedtime, but when I'm not touring, I'm around my daughter for full days for long stretches of time. So if you do the math, I probably come out ahead on quality time. And I'm more fun than normal parents. I've got blue hair and tattoos and sometimes wear a skirt. Darla's friends ask me why I wear nail polish, and I tell them, because I'm a rock star and I do whatever I want. When Darla's school had career day, the kids didn't care much about the dad who worked in software or the dad who designed medical supplies, but the kids ate it up when I showed up with a guitar and played a song I'd written for them called I Don't Want to Go to School. There's a photo from that day of Darla looking up at me as I'm playing, and the look of pride in her eyes absolutely kills me every time I see it. Darla has brought balance to my life. Part of the reason Aaron and I wanted to have a kid in the first place was because we realized we'd been taking our drinking and drug use a bit too far. Coke wasn't just something I did on tour anymore or something we saved for big holiday parties. We were doing it on random nights at home. When I'm around Darla, I don't want to be wasted. I don't even want to be hungover. I want to be present. I want to experience the moment and create all the memories I possibly can. So, as much as I party on the road or with friends, being around Darla forces me to sober up and fly straight for as much time as I'm with her. But in the beginning, I hadn't exactly figured that part out yet. Erin was sober for the whole time she was pregnant and for at least a year.